Hi, and welcome to the Norwalk Hour for Wednesday, October 9th. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll begin with a front page article headlined, Final Steel Beam Tops South Norwalk School. First neighborhood school in South Norwalk in over 40 years, set to open in the fall of 2025. This article by Colleen Rose Ozanek. School district leaders, along with the city and state officials, stood chattering while taking turns at signing their names on a white steel beam, the last finishing touch on the skeleton of the new South Norwalk School. Their excitement came ahead of that steel beam, bedecked with an artificial tree roughly 3 feet tall on one end and an American flag on the other, being raised atop the structure of the soon-to-be school. Mike Buswell, who represented Building, Sales, and Development at Eastern Metalworks Incorporated, one of the school's project's subcontractors under Newfield Construction, said that he wasn't sure of the official reason for the artificial tree balancing the flag on the beam, but said it represented growth and opportunity to him. This sentiment abounded at the Tuesday morning ceremony for the beam topping, where Mayor Harry Rilling, State Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff, Common Council President Darlene Young, Norwalk Public Schools Superintendent Alexandra Estrella, donned a pink cowgirl hard hat, and others applauded the opportunity the school will offer to the community once completed. The principal of South Norwalk School emphasized the importance of the first new neighborhood school in the area in over 40 years. His school's current campus is the site of the old Columbus Magnet School, which has since been renamed and relocated to 21 Hunters Lane as Concord Magnet School. "I feel the joy," Principal Randall Austin said. "I'm excited for the joy we're going to fill these halls with." Austin said he's most excited for the school and community events programming that can take place in the school's new school's gym, noting that being the principal of the school in the neighborhood he grew up in is rewarding. "The students will be equally eager to enter the new school building," Superintendent Estrella said. "It's going to be very exciting for the kids to transfer over and be able to graduate in the new complex. This is a site that symbolizes a lot of community advocacy and efforts to ensure students have a place that they can go with home close by. Without traveling far to go to another school, students can be fully immersed in the learning experience," she said. The new school building, on which crews broke ground in April, is a marker of development and progress in education on Norwalk, Duff said. "Today marks a significant milestone not only for the South Norwalk community, but for the future of education in our city," he said. "This new school represents a long overdue investment in our children, giving them a state-of-the-art facility to learn and thrive." The school at One Meadow Street Extension is slated to open and welcome students in the fall of 2025, initially serving pre-kindergarten through third-grade students. It will phase in additional grades in the following years to serve up to fifth-grade students. With funding for a nearby roundabout, the new school will emphasize community, walkability, and safety, according to City Department of Transportation, Mobility, and Parking Director Jim Travers. The school building project itself has a 60% reimbursement rate from the state. "It will save our taxpayers millions and millions of dollars," Rilling said of the project, priced at $76 million. And in Darien, a second resident appeals tree removal. This article by Molly Hirsch. A second appeal has been filed in court against Darien's planned removal of more than a dozen trees on Great Island. For the past month, the town has found itself embroiled over the removal of 15 trees on Darien's Great Island, which was slated to come down to make way for a two-way access road onto the 60-acre town-owned property. Following a public hearing on September 12th, Darien's tree warden, Michael Cotta, issued his decision to remove the trees along Great Island Road on September 16th. Darien resident Alexis Sweet filed an appeal with Stamford Superior Court on September 26th, claiming the town tree warden's decision to remove the tree on Great Island would cause irreparable harm to the fauna environment on the historic estate and directly impact her enjoyment of Great Island and make her more reluctant to visit. Sweet is the second complaint filed against Takata's decision. Resident Los Helena Bueno filed a complaint on September 25th, claiming Cata acted illegally, arbitrarily, and in abuse of his discretion in his decision regarding the trees. In her complaint, Sweet claimed the town has sufficient emergency access to Great Island, mentioning easements the town has onto the neighboring private property. She pointed to the purchase of the traffic circle on Great Island, done separately from the larger property, which First Selectman John Zagrotsky said at the time, 100% takes care of all access issues. Town officials have repeatedly stated the need for a two-way road to get onto Great Island, not only for emergency access, but also for the other 21,700 people in this town who want to access Great Island, as Selectman Monica McNally said during the September 12th hearing. Residential vehicles are not currently allowed to park on or access the property. In regard to the additional easements, a supplement posted to the town website on September 17th said that a negotiated easement onto the private Ziegler property is intended only for catastrophic emergencies where the main entrance road is inaccessible. Sweet's complaint took issue with Zagrodsky's statement regarding a second session, saying the tree warden could not have made a final decision and therefore complied with state statute because Zagrodsky had indicated trees would not be removed until there was additional communication. No second session was scheduled before the tree warden's September 16th decision. The supplement was posted to the town website on September 17th, outlining some of the reasons for the tree removal. Zagrotsky confirmed to Hearst, Connecticut on September 17th that no second session was planned, though he recommended residents reach out to him with any concerns. Sweet also claimed that Cotta did not comply with state statute by not issuing an opinion with his decision that public safety demanded the removal of the 15 trees on Great Island. Sweet is seeking a declaratory judgment that public safety does not demand the trees' removal and a permanent injunction prohibiting their removal. Alternatively, she is seeking a temporary injunction against the trees' removal until an additional hearing is held, as promised by the town's first selectman, and until Cotta produces an opinion. In Westport, Staples High Theater upgrade is expected to cost more than $1.5 million. This front page article by Kayla Mutchler. It's been over 30 years since some of the equipment within the Staples High School Theater has been upgraded, and that's going to come at a price point of $1.5 million, almost triple the amount that had been approved for the project. Major heating and cooling lines run above the existing lighting platform, and to make that platform safe, it will need to be extended with structural steel, but the lines will have to be redirected, District Facilities Director Ten Hunyadi said. And if this needs to be done, it makes sense to do the other projects at the same time. We need to ask for what we think is right, said Board of Education Chair Lee Goldstein at the September 19th board meeting. There are other issues with lighting, rigging, and the sound system, which haven't been renovated since 1993, said John Koplas, a project manager for Collier's Project Leaders. About $463,000 has already been approved from the town for the heating and cooling, but the cost is estimated to be about $1.5 million for fiscal year 2025, with lighting added to the project. The cost could increase if the theater's sound system is added in. Elio Longo, District Chief Finance Officer, tasked the facilities department to identify safety issues within the auditorium. After doing so, department staff realized all of the lighting and its manual rigging is old technology. Longo asked those who use the theater how well it works, and many said it didn't work, with the common problem being the sound system. After speaking with Longo and the superintendent, Thomas Scarice, officials determined it made sense to do all of the projects at once. Someone also got hurt on the lighting rig last year, Goldstein said. Board member Robert Harrington said it would be worth figuring out how much money they would save by doing all of the projects at once, rather than saving up, especially for when they have to present the project to the Board of Finance. There isn't an estimate on when this project would occur, but Scarice said the district always tries to do these types of projects over the summer. The sound system is terrible. The acoustics are bad. You can only hear if you're in the center orchestra, Goldstein said. This project will go to the Board of Finance in November and representative town meeting after that for further approval. Elsewhere, a new Canaan man gets a year in prison for avoiding $272,000 in taxes. This article by Josh LaBella. A new Canaan man has been sentenced to just over a year in prison after admitting to avoiding hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes, federal officials said. Vishal Dar was sentenced to 12 months and one day in prison, followed by 2 years of supervised release, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Connecticut's office said in a news release on Monday. The U.S. Attorney's office said Dar formed and operated various entities, including Gray Brown Incorporated, a holding company for several restaurants operating under the name Oaxa Taqueria. It said he also operated West Partners Incorporated and New York Cloud Kitchens, LLC. From approximately October 2013 through August 2023, the U.S. Attorney's Office said, Dar did not disclose significant income to the IRS he earned from his businesses and gifts from family members. Instead of paying his taxes, it said, he paid off personal and business debts, invested in a new business venture, and paid various personal expenses. The U.S. Attorney's Office said Dar used financial accounts in the names of entities and other individuals rather than his own name to evade taxes. It said he also paid personal expenses with corporate funds and omitted significant assets on his IRS forms. In the bankruptcy case of Gray Brown, which was filed in the Southern District of New York, the U.S. Attorney's Office said Dar failed to disclose the receipt of an employee retention credit check in the amount of $254,000 made payable to Oaxa Atlantic Avenue, LLC. It said that money is a refundable tax credit for certain eligible business and tax-exempt organizations that had employees and were affected during the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. Attorney's Office said Dar owed $272,390 in back taxes, penalties, and interest for the 2011 through 2020 tax years. He has paid full restitution, it said. Dar pleaded guilty to tax evasion on May 23rd, the U.S. Attorney's Office said, and is free on bond until he is scheduled to report to prison on February 12th. Also from today's front page, Blumenthal travels to Israel to meet with Netanyahu. This article by Ken Dixon. On the first anniversary of the October 7th attacks by Hamas, U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on Monday met for a frank and candid hour with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to talk about potential paths for peace and in hopes of avoiding a widening war that could explode in the Middle East. We expressed our support for Israel's right to defend itself, and at the same time, as Israel is succeeding militarily, it also has to seek diplomatic efforts to be successful for the peace that's necessary after military success, Blumenthal said in a phone interview on Monday afternoon at about 8 p.m. local time in Jerusalem, shortly after another rocket attack on Israel. Blumenthal and U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, often traveling companions to world hotspots, including the Middle East and Ukraine, also met Monday with the family of an Israeli hostage captured by Hamas during the attacks last year that killed 1,500 Israelis. Those attacks sparked the subsequent attacks on Gaza, killing about 40,000 Palestinians, threatening a wider war with neighboring countries, including Lebanon and Iran. We had a frank and candid discussion with him and other leaders, Blumenthal said of the meeting in Netanyahu's office. Blumenthal and Graham also met with Israel Katz, the nation's foreign minister, as well as Amir Ohana, Speaker of the Israeli Parliament. I think my takeaway from today is not only the official meetings, but also conversations about how raw and real the pain and grief still is, Blumenthal said. We talked at some length with the Prime Minister about how he has to move forward and seize the moment for promoting peace, and how our hope is that steps can be taken to bring home the hostages, to provide a path to normalized relations between other nations and Israel, and to provide for more humanitarian aid, Blumenthal, who has family in Israel, spoke shortly after an emotional meeting with the relatives of the hostage. He said that diplomacy is necessary to provide for the future after combat has ceased, hostages return to Israel, and more humanitarian aid flows to Gaza. The duo's itinerary includes meeting other Israeli leaders, including other top officials, on Tuesday, before flying on to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for a face-to-face with Mohammed bin Salman al-Saud, the controversial prime minister, with hopes for a ceasefire and revived peace talks. "I'm more hopeful than ever that there is a path toward peace, which includes bringing the hostages home and a path to normalization of relations between these countries, which would be historic and in everyone's interest," Blumenthal said, adding that he and Graham, ranking Republican on the Senate Budget Committee, have been journeying together to the Middle East for about a year and a half. "There are still a lot of moving parts, and we're going to be bringing serious messages back to our colleagues, as well as the president, about the urgency of moving forward." He said that Israelis seem impressed by the bipartisan cooperative effort from the two senators, a Northeastern Democrat and a Southern Conservative. "We are completely committed to work together," Blumenthal said. In an earlier interview on Monday morning, Blumenthal recalled how he has family in Israel. "My dad came to America in 1935 at 17 years old," he said. "He spoke no English and knew no one. The German-born Martin Blumenthal borrowed money to bring to the United States his parents and other close relatives, including his father's sister, who stayed in the U.S. for a few years, then moved to Israel and raised a family. I'm hoping to talk with them, actually," he said of family members. Blumenthal was on social media during the anniversary day, hoping for diplomacy, an end to the fighting, the return of hostages, and a rebuilding of the war-torn landscape. "The searing shock, agony, and outrage of that day is still raw and deep," Blumenthal wrote. "I also remember vividly the resolve and resilience of the Jewish community in Connecticut and around the country. Over the last year, I have come to know closely many of the hostage families, and I am in awe of them." In a front-page article by Alex Putterman, more than 500,000 state households earn below true living wage, the report says. The number of Connecticut residents earning less than a living wage has increased in recent years, new data suggests, as life in the state becomes increasingly difficult to afford. According to a new report from the United Way of Connecticut, nearly 564,000 households, 39% of the state's total, fell below the threshold at which they can afford essentials in 2022. That's up 13% from 2019. These households are particularly concentrated in urban areas, but can be found in every zip code in the state, the report says. The United Way report focuses on those classified as ALICE, asset limited, income constrained, and employed. In other words, people who have jobs but still don't have enough to support themselves and their families. According to the report, 29% of Connecticut households fit this definition, along with 11% who fall below the poverty line. ALICE families face difficult choices every day, balancing their budget by having to choose between such things as paying their utilities, groceries, or putting much-needed tires on their cars, said Dina Sears Graves, president of the United Way of Southeastern Connecticut. They struggle to pay bills, compromise their well-being and their families, and just can't ever get ahead. Based on United Way calculations, a single adult would have needed to earn $18 an hour, or about $35,000 a year, to live in Connecticut in 2022, while an adult with a child would have needed to earn twice as much, and a household with two adults and two children would have needed to earn about $114,000 a year. The United Way says these thresholds are likely more than 10% higher in 2024, amid rising costs of living in Connecticut and elsewhere. The ALIS threshold is notably higher than the federal poverty level, which Maura Cook, as the United Way of Central and Northeastern Connecticut, described as really not sufficient to tell us who is struggling to make ends meet, in part because it doesn't factor in the cost of living in a particular region. Connecticut consistently ranks as one of the most expensive states to live in, with housing costs in particular straining families statewide, most of all in Fairfield County. At a news conference Tuesday, residents whose households fit the ALIS criteria shared their struggles to afford rent, food, gas, childcare, and more. "These basic human necessities are highly unaffordable," said Jacqueline Torres, a 24-year-old single mom from West Haven. "They're unrealistic." According to the United Way's report, ALIS households in Connecticut are disproportionately likely to be Black and Hispanic. Among all occupations, personal care aides were most likely to qualify as ALIS, followed by nursing assistants, cooks, and fast food workers. In presenting its report, the United Way also shared survey data showing 58% of ALIS families say it's difficult to afford basics. 40% experience housing cost increases in the past year. The United Way report argues the best way to address the rise in ALIS households would be to establish a $600 annual Connecticut's Child Tax Credit, which they say would benefit about 250,000 households and 550,000 children, along with an expansion of the federal Child Tax Credit. "Because of the high cost of living in Connecticut, we really need both an expanded federal and a refundable state-level child tax credit to make ends meet," said Daniel Fitzmaurice, the United Way's director of advocacy. Several state legislators joined United Way officials at Tuesday's news conference, speaking in support of a child tax credit and other policies to help working and middle-class residents. "I hear from families every day who are ALIS families, who are struggling to pay their bills, who are struggling to save," said Representative Kate Farrar, a Democrat representing parts of West Hartford and Newington. "Today is a testament to what we must do together for them and our entire state." Representative Anthony Nolan, a New London Democrat, argued for tweaking the state's fiscal guardrails during next year's legislative session to fund a child tax credit. In health and safety news, COVID, RSV, and flu cases are expected to rise soon in Connecticut. This article by Jordan Nathaniel Fenster. Though COVID-19 never truly disappeared over the summer in Connecticut, health officials say rates of COVID and many other respiratory diseases should soon start trending upward. "Respiratory viral disease season is definitely upon us," said State Department of Public Health Commissioner Manisha Jitani during a Monday news conference. "The rate of flu and RSV in Connecticut have been and remain low, according to the state's seasonal respiratory disease tracker, which opened up publicly again on Monday. But COVID-19 rates spiked in August and have been simmering since then." "We've had plenty of COVID. It's around," Jitani said. "It's never really bottomed out for us in the last several weeks. COVID, as much as I have willed and wished for it to become a seasonal virus, it really has not completely done that," she said. Scott Roberts, Associate Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Yale New Haven Hospital, said despite the lack of seasonality of COVID, residents should expect more respiratory illness as the weather gets colder, forcing more people indoors. "We are now very aware of respiratory viruses that buck the seasonality trend. COVID is really the clear example there," he said, "though there are still many that follow the general tried-and-true trends of peaks in the winter and then lulls in the summer. RSV rates can be expected to increase, and flu as well as other common viruses. Human metapneumoviruses tend to peak in February and March," Roberts said, "as do non-COVID coronaviruses. Para-influenza also tends to hit in the winter, he said. About 2.4% of all hospitalizations in Connecticut since the beginning of August have been for COVID-19, according to state data, with about 200 every week across the state. That number has fluctuated between 162 hospitalizations to 228 between August and September. There were 23 deaths from COVID-19 the week ending August 24th, and though that number has dropped since then, there have been a total of 70 deaths in Connecticut from COVID-19 since the beginning of August. Most of those deaths have been among people aged 80 years or older. It is our oldest age groups that are impacted the most, Giuttani said. Definitely our 80 and older age group the most, but everybody, as we proceed from 40 upwards, is where we see our burden of disease. Roberts speculated that the winter COVID season may be better than it had been in previous years. I predict it will be a better COVID winter than last winter, he said, precisely because the virus has not become seasonal and never fully abated. I would still predict the winter peak, but we had a summer peak, he said. A lot of people got infected in August, and they're probably not going to get infected again this winter. Or maybe they will in the spring, but certainly they'll have a number of months of strong protection. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last month approved newly formulated vaccines to combat the symptoms of COVID-19, and though Giuttani said the vaccine will help prevent you from getting into the hospital, uptake has remained low among all age groups. A total of 155,765 people in Connecticut have received the updated COVID vaccine as of October 5th. Of the total number of people who have received the updated vaccine, 40.9% of those over 60 years old. Only 15.38%, or 23,957 people, are 80 years old or older. Though many doctors' offices and pharmacies offer both the COVID and flu vaccines simultaneously, nearly double the number of flu vaccines have been administered in the same time period. This is not new. We've seen this over the last couple of seasons, Giuttani said. About half over the last couple of seasons have gotten the COVID shot relative to the number of people who got a flu shot. And right now, we're a little bit better than that, more than half. I'm hoping that we continue that trajectory. When asked why fewer people get vaccinated against COVID, Giuttani said there may be several answers. Some might be concerned about symptoms or feel that they can fight the disease off themselves. Certainly, there's a bit of COVID fatigue, she said. And in another article by Jordan Nathaniel Fenster, the state recalls bottles of raw milk, citing a bacterial contamination. It's legal to sell raw milk in Connecticut, but a recall has prompted state officials to warn residents against drinking it. The State Department of Agriculture has issued a recall of bottled raw milk produced by Bridgewater Farm Nature View Dairy after the state confirmed two human cases of Campylobacter illness related to the product. In addition to the two cases of illness, state investigators found the Campylobacter bacteria in other samples of bottled raw milk. Consumers should be cautious when ingesting raw milk products, especially those in high-risk categories, said State Agriculture Commissioner Brian Hurlbut in a news release. NatureView Dairy, which is voluntarily complying with the recall, according to the Department of Agriculture, specializes in raw milk, according to the farm's website. Real milk, milk that is pasture-raised, full-fat, and unprocessed, is an inherently safe food, the website says. According to public health officials, pasteurization is necessary to make raw milk safe and to extend shelf life. These officials insist that pasteurization does not harm the nutritional value of milk. Such statements are erroneous, misleading, and factually incorrect. In addition to their own farm stand, NatureView Dairy sells milk and milk-derived products at markets in and around the Danbury area, including Caraluzzi's markets in Newtown, Bethel, Georgetown, and Danbury, Laban's market in Watertown, and Nature's Temptations in Ridgefield, among other places. And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and you've been listening to the Wednesday, October 9th edition of the Norwalk Hour. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.